You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Monday, September 28th, 2020.
And I think the community is more than ready for us to be open again. So here we are.
Later in the program, the Monroe County Public Library reopened today with limited in-person services. WFHB News Director Cade Young sat down and spoke with Greer Carson in a socially distant interview. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up, a few minutes with the mayor. In today's segment, Mayor John Hamilton talks about the state moving into stage 5 of its reopening plan. He also discusses a vigil held last week in remembrance of 39 community members who died while experiencing homelessness in Monroe County. But first, your daily headlines. Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudill said the COVID-19 positivity rate was 3.5% during the September 25th COVID-19 press conference. She said the county health order would remain the same in light of the new state order.
What the changes in his order, his executive order might be, and how that might affect ours. Yesterday, on Thursday, we were able to actually review the back on track and look at the executive order. And after reviewing it, we did determine that at this time, we don't need to change our current regulations or health order. We will continue to monitor that and determine if we need to make changes. However, with that, I do want to make some clarifications because I know there will be questions about some of those things. As the mayor said, we still have locally lower limits on social gatherings. In the county, it's 50. In the city, it's 15. For commercial events or venues, it's 100 if it's indoors, it's 150 if it's outdoors.
Caudill said violations of gathering size limits should be reported to the non-emergency Bloomington Police Department phone number. She reported dine-in bars and restaurants cannot have bar top service and groups must remain 6 feet apart. Indiana University Assistant Vice President of Strategic Partnerships, Kirk White, mentioned IU campus flu vaccinations.
Our planning continues for the flu clinics that we will have on campus to vaccinate a large percentage of the campus. We're also encouraging people to use their private sector providers, but we'll have it available for everybody on campus who wants a flu shot. We'll have points of distribution set up probably starting in mid-October to get those out.
President of Indiana University Health South Central Region, Brian Shockney, said IU Health clinics are providing flu vaccinations.
The Monroe County Solid Waste Management Board approved a resolution on September 23rd for a Rumpke Waste and Recycling Resource Recovery Facility at 5220 South Production Drive. Board member Cheryl Munson said this would not be a landfill.
I'd like to begin our meeting by clarifying that the resolution, which is our first order of business, does not pertain to a proposed landfill, as there have been comments in text messages and on Facebook about this. It is for a waste and recycling transfer station. It is also not for a material recovery facility or MRF. That's another point of confusion. It is for a transfer station at the location of a previously planned trucking facility.
Community member Lindsay Alexander questioned what the plant would include. She mentioned concerns about property value and odors. Rumpke Director of Business Development Ted Nira said the waste would be controlled.
You know, will it have odors? The short answer is no. We're required by law to control those odors. The waste and recyclables will be dumped inside. It'll all be moved in and out daily. So it's not a repository, as it were. It's not a landfill. There won't be an accumulation of waste or recyclables on site of any significance. So As far as property values go, that's a broader question.
Nura said surrounding land uses complement their proposed use. Resident Denise Robertson mentioned road deterioration. Consultant Christina Selbert referenced a traffic study and pavement analysis. She mentioned procedures for facility maintenance.
When we talk about the redundancy that it's going to provide, the concern that maybe this would cause material to back up and end up being here for a longer period of time, really this facility will prevent those types of circumstances from arising in the county by giving a second option in case your existing facility down the road would become unavailable or would have some backup of material. This is an overflow, possibly, but we still have to comply with those state regulations, and we need to move that material out every day. At the end of the day, we do have to clean the floor. We have to wash down the floor on a routine basis, according to the permit. All that wash water gets handled as a sanitary sewer material. So we have to either collect it in a tank or we have to send it in the sewer system. We have to have the proper permits for that. And it's not going to be running off and running out of the building.
The board's approval deemed the facility as needed and in compliance with the district's solid waste management plan. Rumpke still requires approval from the Monroe County Commissioner, Planning Commission, and the Board of Zoning Appeals.
Now it's time for your feature reports. The Monroe County Public Library reopened today with limited in-person services. WFHB News Director Cade Young sat down with Grier Carson, Associate Director of the Library, for a socially distant interview. For more on what the reopening will look like, we turn to Cade Young.
A hand sanitizer station greets people at the door. Staff and patrons wear masks while keeping their distance. Patrons use computers and browse the bookshelves. Grier Carson, Associate Director of the Monroe County Public Library, talks about what limited reopening looks like. He discussed what those limited in-person services entail, safety protocols, and how the library aims to protect at-risk people. As the library reopens today, Carson touched on specific in-person services available.
The first is access to the physical collections. So we're reopening to allow the community to browse the collections again. Up to this point, it's been through holds only. So you place a hold online, you have a curbside pickup kind of solution, and we get if things ready for you, you grab and go. What we're doing now is reopening the doors so people have access to the physical collections, but still emphasizing, come in, grab your stuff, check it out, and go. So that's the first. And the second is access to technology. We've provided, actually in this room with the setup you're seeing right now, technology used by appointment. We've been doing that for a few weeks. Now that we've opened the doors, folks can come in and have up to an hour long session on a computer. And we have fewer computers available than we usually do just to keep the social distancing factor in place, but those computers are available. So those are the main reasons, the main things that people can come back and do.
Carson touched on library services patrons can still use in this limited reopening stage.
So certainly all of the collections, so that would be books, DVDs, CDs, video games, audiobooks, and all of the other kind of nuanced collections that we have. What we're not including are things like toys, instruments, things that are very hands-on that we do circulate. For all the obvious reasons, we're not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the technology, we have Mac and PC workstations. We have the Level Up studio downstairs, which has access to Adobe Creative Suite, Ableton Logic, and some audio and video production tools. So those are on specific machines downstairs. And that's kind of really the bulk of it. Certainly access to our staff in terms of providing reference support, reader's advisory, or just answering general questions is another thing that the community has access to.
He talked about how the library aims to protect at-risk patrons, mainly by reserving the first hour of each day for at-risk people only.
Well, the first is masks are required, period, end. So nobody gets in the building without a mask. Even if people have an accommodation and they can't wear a mask, then what we're going to say is, well, we will do our best to accommodate you with a curbside service or something else, but you can't come in the building without a mask. The second thing is we have spaced out all of our desks, all of our self-checkout machines, and a lot of the shelving, particularly for the new arrivals and the holds, you'll notice are spread way far apart, in some cases as far apart as 10 feet. So we've really kind of redesigned a lot of the library since we've been closed to allow for proper social distancing when on site. But specifically to high-risk folks, we are reserving the first hour of every day for high-risk only. 11 to 12 every day, except Sunday we open at 12 and then 12 to 1, is just for high-risk individuals.
Carson said the library will continue its outreach services, van deliveries, and bookmobile stops. Bookmobile, essentially a library service on wheels, offers collections of high-demand material for people of all ages. As for safety protocols, the library mandates masks to be worn at all times and social distancing. I asked Carson how the library intends to enforce social distancing and mask wearing.
So that's a good question, and we're going to do it gently but firmly. We've already had this morning a few folks show up either with a mask down around their neck, not covering their nose, whatever it is, and just a very polite and respectful, hey, love to have you come in the library, got to make sure you're covering that nose and keeping it snug, is going to be our approach. And we think in 90% of the cases that's going to be enough, because we're all getting used to this new part of our daily attire, and a lot of times you find yourself letting it slip, or you get sick of it and you just drop it down, and that's fine. People are going to do that. So we're going to remind folks that can't do that when you're at the library. If and when we do run into a sticky situation, we do have security on site. We have protocol for helping our staff deal with those difficult situations and ultimately keeping everyone who visits the library safe. So we do have that in place, but we don't expect that's going to be an issue.
Items are quarantined for 4 days once they are returned. However, Carson asked patrons to do their part in order for library materials to stay sanitized.
But what we've seen in terms of the best results, that is more than sufficient to ensure that these materials are reasonably safe. We're continuing to quarantine materials now. Even though we're reopening, when stuff gets turned in, it doesn't actually get checked off your account. It just goes straight into a bin and gets wheeled into a room on the first floor, and we don't touch it. And when its day comes, then we check it in and we reshelve it. We're not physically sanitizing or wiping down materials because, one, that's operationally not feasible. And in terms of our staff workflow, it's an impediment to doing everything else we need to do. And so we're saying to the public, like a lot of people are saying, take personal responsibility in this equation. Assume that if you're touching something, it maybe isn't safe, and act accordingly. That means wash your hands, wipe the materials down yourself at home once you get them. That's fine. And that's worked out pretty well so far. Occasionally we get questions about, why are these items still on my account? Does it mean I can't check out more items? And we say no. It doesn't impact borrowing. Just because it's sitting in the quarantine bin doesn't mean you can't check out another 10 DVDs. So we're a little bit of amnesty and flexibility right now in terms of people borrowing stuff, but we're going to keep quarantining materials through this entire pandemic.
Carson mentioned how drive-up pickup has replaced curbside pickup. In the beginning of the pandemic, the library began to implement curbside pickup, which allowed people to check out books online. However, they still had to go inside the library to pick up their books. Starting today, that will no longer be the case.
It replaces it in that if you want minimal contact with the library, and particularly with staff, that's your way to do it. Rather than placing materials out on the shelves in the vestibule and calling it curbside, even though people are coming in to pick up their stuff, we're just doing it through drive-up the way we used to, except we have plexiglass barriers in place. You know, staff have masks and shields and gloves. And we're actually looking at ways that we can provide a drawer going forward so that's even more contactless. But because we've had a lot of calls for us to reopen the drive-up, and because a lot of people who are used to curbside services through businesses and restaurants see the drive-up as the equivalent for us, it just makes good sense to shift the curbside process to that. And that way, when people are coming into the library to visit us, they don't have to walk past the curbside patrons either, because we kind of have a limited amount of space in the vestibule. So it's best for everybody to shift the curbside or contactless experience to the drive-up and let the doorway to the library be the doorway again. So that's kind of what we're doing. If and when we have a situation where someone says, I'm uncomfortable with the drive up, or I have a medical exemption, I can't wear a mask, can't come in the library, can't go up to the drive up because masks are required to drive up as well. We will work with those folks. We'll do a bring it to your car, put it in your trunk kind of thing, case by case basis.
Back in March, the Monroe County Public Library began to waive late fees. Carson said late fees were extraneous and not an effective deterrent for late checkouts.
The Fine Free Initiative was actually independent of the pandemic. We started working on it last summer, and it just happened to be approved about end of January, early February. So it preceded the pandemic and then turned out to be a really good thing. It's helpful because, as you put it, we're not slapping people with overdue fees. We've felt for a long time that that just isn't necessary. It's not beneficial in terms of our operations. Actually doesn't serve as a deterrent for people keeping stuff out too long, and we've seen the numbers to prove that. So we were left thinking like, well, what purpose do fines actually serve? They're kind of a legacy library approach, and a lot of libraries have stopped doing it. Why are we still doing it? And we came out very clearly on the side of, we want to encourage use. We don't want to punish people. And the worst thing that could happen is somebody keeps an item too long, like they own it now. And then that's what we'll do. We'll just say, okay, well, if you're going to keep it, we're going to bill you for it. And you can't use the library until you either bring the thing back or pay the bill down. So it's very clear cut. It's very simple. It's beneficial in the pandemic for maybe the most obvious reason is we don't have a bunch of people worrying, hey, am I going to get overdue charges for all this stuff because I can't bring it back to the library, you know, or I'm unable to get out of the house, I'm sheltering in place or whatever it is. And then for us, it's beneficial because we don't have to go in and manage a system with a bunch of accounts and say, eliminate this person's fines, but not this person, and so on. So it's just nice and clean for everybody, and the timing worked out well. It's one of the few things related to the pandemic where the timing was good.
Finally, Carson explained why the library is an important community resource in general, and especially during a pandemic.
It's a democratizing institution. It provides free and equitable access to anybody, regardless of who you are, where you are, what your opinion is, how much money you have. We're here for everybody. And if you're a citizen of Monroe County, you can get a card, an account, and borrow stuff, a lot of stuff, for a long period of time. Even if you're not, you can come in and sit down and use a computer or browse the collection and so on. And so, you know, it sounds like an exaggeration, but we're a highly democratic institution, public libraries are. And that's incredibly important during a pandemic when people are, number one, anxious, afraid, uncertain, and they need reassurance. And they need reassurance from credible sources, and libraries tend to curate credible sources for the general population. It's also important in a pandemic like this, where for various reasons, there's a lot of noise out there in the media, and there are a lot of conflicting recommendations, suppositions, and so on that add to that anxiety. And I think having a stable, information-focused, equitable institution like a public library just serves to help people in that regard. And that's another reason why we're very excited to be opening now, because our digital and our virtual access to resources for the community has been great, and we've seen an explosion in the amount of use those resources get and the number of people interacting with the library online. But for some people, there is no substitution to coming back into this building and having access to those books, those films, those games, that music, and maybe even just interfacing with staff a little bit on the state of the world. And that's something that we provide, and I think we do a pretty good job at it. And I think the community is more than ready for us to be open again. So here we are.
For WFHB, I'm Cade Young.
Up next, a few minutes with the mayor, where WFHB Assistant News Director Sydney Foreman talks to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about local issues. In today's installment, Mayor Hamilton talks about what Stage 5 means for Bloomington. In addition, Foreman questions Hamilton on a vigil at the Courthouse Square in remembrance of the 39 community members living in Monroe County who died in the past year while experiencing homelessness.
Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions. The first question that we have today is, what are your thoughts on Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb opening up the state to stage 5, referring to things as, quote, going back to normal?
I am disappointed, and I think it's a wrong move. The governor is, in my view, not really listening to the science and to the health experts and looking at the basic indicators. Indiana still has a 70-day positivity average that was over 5%. Those are some of the baselines that the World Health Organization and others recommend. I'm concerned that it's driven more by a desire to get back to normal than really following the science. So the governor does give local authorities authority to do our own restrictions, which is very important and good. And I expect locally we will continue for some time the mask ordinance and the gathering size limits, because we're just not out of the woods yet. There's clear indications of continued risk, and the cost of continuing these controls is not nearly as high as the cost of going through a resurgence.
And so on September 23rd, a vigil in remembrance of the 39 community members living in Monroe County who died in this past year while experiencing homelessness was held on the courthouse lawn. This number is larger than in the past few years. And what is your reaction to this as mayor?
That ceremony is one that I have often attended in the past. I was not able to do so this year. And I find it a very powerful and meaningful gathering and ceremony to remember people who far too often are not remembered as explicitly. And I really do appreciate that gathering. It means a lot to me. It reminds us as a community of any time we lose a member of our community, whether they're housed or not, it's a loss to our community. This has been a hard year in many ways for the community, losing people and going through the COVID experience. I continue to focus on affordable housing and increasing opportunity with a housing first model that says the response to homelessness is to get a home. That's what we need to focus on and continue to try to expand that kind of opportunity. And we'll continue to do the really strong and important partnerships with so many providers who help respond to the needs. But that's a very powerful night for the city, and I appreciate that it happens here and reflects a lot of the values of so many people who live in our city.
And could you speak about those partnerships that you mentioned? How exactly does the city work with these either shelters or other services that provide help to people experiencing homelessness?
Sure. Well, they're many partnerships. They range from partnerships to actually build and operate housing, like we've done in Crawford 1 and Crawford 2, and that's with Life Design and Shalom both participating, and other projects like up on Kinzer Pike, a new project that's getting ready to open that's focused on people with disabilities or special needs or homelessness, as well as the project we're doing at right next to Switchyard Park. So there's a lot of partnerships to actually just to create housing. Then there's kind of shelter services and emergency services where we cooperate with New Leaf, New Life and New Hope for Families. New Hope for Families and Shalom and Wheeler Mission and others that work at Middleway House that work to help provide services. We partner with financial support through Jack Hopkins grants and others. There's work helping people get jobs, like a great program we have, a Centerstone, that helps people who are clients of Centerstone to actually get into workplace with city jobs. We've seen some really important success with that, and we're investing more in that. So, there are dozens of food security and others where we help support with financing. There are dozens of partnerships that are involved in that. Even special ones this year with the COVID challenge, where we worked with the State Family and Social Services Administration and local partners to stand up an isolation shelter if people who didn't have another place to go needed to isolate because of a diagnosis or exposure to COVID. So it's still not enough. We still have big challenges dealing with homelessness, people experiencing homelessness, people experiencing substance use disorder or mental illness, and these partnerships are key to responding well to that.
And do you have any insight on what may have caused such a rise in deaths this year? Or maybe it's just a COVID-related thing or something else?
I don't. I'm sorry. I've not seen the specific incidents. And, you know, it could be related to disease and COVID exposure. I'm not sure. I think we've had a higher number in our point in time count this year. So there could be more people experiencing homelessness in our community. But I think that's a good question to ask. And it's one that we'll be continuing to work on. Again, it's really important for people to remember that the vast majority of people who experience homelessness do so for a temporary time, for a short period, usually where it's a family breakup or a health crisis or a job crisis or other kind of economic dislocation that causes homelessness to hit, that can hurt kids in school, can hurt families. A lot of people who are homeless are kids and families. And the vast majority of homeless go into homelessness and then get out of homelessness. And that's what we want to particularly do, is accelerate and speed up it so that nobody's in homelessness for very long. Then there's a small subset that are chronically homeless, that for long-term homeless, and that's very dangerous and bad for health, and kind of a different challenge sometimes. But all of those are really important issues to me and to our administration and to our community, I think.
The next question that I have is, high school students are being asked to apply for the third annual Teen Roundtable. Could you speak about what this is or what teens are able to do in this program?
Each year, our Commission on the Status of Children and Youth has been doing a roundtable where we ask young people to share thoughts and ideas about our community and vision for the future, and over a group of Sundays, I think it's Sundays this year as well, a number of high school students will gather to share ideas, and it's used to help us as a city think about directions to go. And we want to hear from young people with their hopes and dreams and concerns about the future. So we really do encourage anybody interested in that to apply. And it's a really, I think, a very good experience for the young people and very helpful to the city too.
How would someone who's interested in that apply to this discussion?
There are application forms online, I believe, through the Community and Family Resources Department. And you should be able to go to the city website and the CFRD connection and go right there.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our features were produced by Cade Young and Sydney Foreman.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You too can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for With Good Reason, coming up next on WFHB.